All right. Well, I'm excited to be here. I'm going to talk about this work in developing countries. And kind of the first part of the talk will actually be on development, kind of get us on the same page about that. And then I'll talk about actually power and connectivity, and then I'll talk about storage at the end. So the group I'm targeting is, in some sense, the rest of the planet. Historically, technologists are very good with the 1.1 billion people in the industrialized nations, but we don't really address most of the people on the planet, and I think that's a shame. I think there's a role for technology to play in a wide range of ways for the whole planet. So the hardest group is what's called the base of the pyramid, the idea being that you're at the top of the pyramid. Everyone in this room is really at the tippy top of the pyramid in terms of your annual income. The bottom of the pyramid are the people that make less than $2 a day, of which is the majority of the planet, about 4 billion people. It's also the fastest growing segment, so unless we do something, there's going to be more and more people in this category. Historically, they are a rural population, although they're mostly moving to urban areas, not because the quality of life is better, but because there's more social mobility in urban areas. And I'll come back to that point in a little while. Education levels are uneven and low, particularly for women. In general, if you have a family and you can afford to send one person to school, it's probably the oldest son, and too bad for the girls, though it does vary by country. It's also a shame because if you don't educate women, they're actually more likely to have more children. There's a very strong correlation between education of women and reduction of birth rate. So, in fact, if you wanted to think about ways to deal with overpopulation, the number one technique by far is education of women, really to give them other options besides rearing many kids. And although people tend to talk about this as a market, it's not. It's too heterogeneous. It's very fragmented, and it's very hard to make a single solution work all over the world. And we'll come back to that point as well. So that's the target population. The way this has been dealt with traditionally, what I call traditional development, is very top-down. You start with an agency like the World Bank. They say, we're going to fund a dam, and that dam will create jobs and hopefully something like hydropower or energy, and that energy will improve the quality of life of the country. However, this hasn't worked very well. I would say it has 50 years of questionable success. Part of the reason is that these big projects come with strings attached. In the Cold War era, the strings were things like, you need to be on our side or the Soviet side, and that was the reason for giving the money, and the debt was the stick that you then used to get what you wanted from these countries. On top of that, these projects are very difficult to manage. In particular, they tend to be with governments that are high in the corruption index. Not surprisingly, not all the money makes it to the project. But from my perspective, the bigger problem is there's really no role for technology in this model of development. In particular, there's no role for high technology. The possible exception might be medicine or maybe seeds. If you view seeds as a technology, that's actually had some success with the Green Revolution. But in general, the very way these projects work, which is a top-down plan that has a 5 or 10 year horizon, it assumes that technology isn't going to change in the 5 or 10 years that are coming, right? Which, of course, is ridiculous on the surface. And if you're building a dam, a 5 year plan is probably reasonable because the dam technology isn't going to change much in 5 years. But if you're building something else that we want to use technology, you have to have a different methodology. In addition, the agencies that do these things, like the World Bank or International Money Fund, they don't have any people like you in their staff. Right, there's no technical capacity to even judge a good solution. So all of the technology decisions are essentially outsourced by the contractors that implement the project. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, but it's certainly not strategic. Now, compare that with the cell phone success story. This is the most successful technology ever. It's not really even close. About 4 billion users worldwide have a cell phone, or at least a SIM card. Africa's the fastest growing market, although it's only at about 10% coverage. It's not like this is excluding all parts of the world. This is a global phenomenon. It's also getting more lopsided. Last year, there were 1 billion phones sold. That's one every 36 seconds or so. And to put that in perspective, the total number of shoes sold is 15 billion, right? So cell phones are catching up to shoes, right? And I know people that have a cell phone and don't have shoes, by the way. It's not that uncommon. So, you know, put that in respect with PCs, it's 300 million PCs. And we would view PCs as a very successful technology, but it's not close, and that gap is getting wider. And in fact, in a couple years, there'll be more smartphones sold than PCs. And you can think of a smartphone as a 10-year-old PC. A current smartphone, like iPhone 3GS, is about a 1999 Pentium 3, in terms of its MIPS, although it's 100 times less power. So the reason the cell phone's been successful is not because some agency said, okay, we're going to do a cell phone project, and here's $100 million for infrastructure to build out your cellular network. That's not what happened. This was totally driven bottom-up by local demand. And the demand comes from a few things that we need to learn from. One is that voice applications work in all languages. So your cell phone is not made just for English, unlike most computer programs. It works. It solves a need, which is there is a latent need for communications. A good example would be if you're a taxi driver and you have a cell phone, you make quite a bit more income. And that's because people can call you versus having to literally bump into you in the street. Right? So the income that you can get is quite a bit higher. Another example is, which I'll get to in a minute, is a tremendous amount of flow of money from overseas relatives into these countries called remittances. That money is actually coordinated by communications. That communications is via cellular phone, typically. Another thing that's driven up the bottom-up demand is prepaid minutes. So the way you get your minutes for your phone is not by having a credit card, because most people don't have a credit card. It's by going to the equivalent of the 7-Eleven, buying a card, scratching it off. It has a number in it that's a one-time use number. You type that number into your phone, and then you've got 20 more minutes or 50 more minutes of cellular coverage. So another statistic which I didn't put on here is 1.7 billion people have a cell phone but don't have a bank account. Right? And that works because the prepaid cards allow them to participate in the economy without having a credit history or any even collateral. Right? So that's an important part of making this work. But the most important thing to get out of this was not a development project. This is, in some sense, an organic growth, and despite being an organic growth, was completely and by far the most successful development project ever. I don't have the number up here, but it's for every 10% increase in penetration of mobile phones. So if you had 10 mobile phones per 100 people and you went to 20, that's good for 0.8 increase in the GDP of the country. And it's not correlation. It's not because people are buying more cell phones because they're wealthier. You can actually show, and has been shown, that people are wealthier because they have more cell phones. And the taxi cab driver is the kind of microeconomic example that they use to show that causality. So where does this money come from? So I just told you there's this huge thing that was deployed, and it wasn't funded by the World Bank. Where did the money come from? It came from two sources. The main one is remittances. So this is money sent back from overseas relatives. The flows are unbelievable. Here's the aggregate flow to Africa is $40 billion. Philippines is an interesting example. That's one that's particularly relevant for the U.S. If you live in the U.S., you've almost certainly dealt with Filipino nurses. Filipino nurses send a huge amount of money back to the Philippines, $14 billion a year. And 13% of the Philippines' GDP. So the money flowing in from remittances into Africa and countries like the Philippines is actually vastly exceeds the money they receive in aid or in international projects. So in terms of total dollars, this is actually more money to work with. However, it comes in little payments, right? It's $50 here, $100, $200 sent from the relative overseas, typically over a relatively inefficient mechanism. Money transfers can cost, 20% of the money sometimes. I think the average is 23% if you do it at a check cashing station where you're cashing your check and transferring the money overseas. Right, so it's not like it's particularly efficient. But it's a critical part of the economy. It's because of the high transaction rates, it's often done in a gray market or underground, and therefore it's a little bit hard to track. But just take this think of this as the money that pays for technology projects, because this is the money that paid for the cell phone network, right? By individual people buying cell phones. Where do they get the money from their cell phone? In many cases, from overseas. Where do they get the money for their prepaid minutes? In many, but not all cases, from overseas, right? And in fact, if you're an overseas relative, you're happy to pay for minutes so you can talk to your relatives, right? That's a very good use of the money. The other source is microfinance, which is hopefully you've heard of by now because of Muhammad Yunus getting the Nobel Prize a few years ago. He created a bank called Grameen Bank, and he got this idea because he noticed that if he loaned money to his wealthy friends, they may or may not pay him back, but when he loaned money to his poor friends, they always paid him back. And the reason for that is to his poor friends, it was a big deal to get the loan. It meant something important to them, and they took it very seriously, and they wanted the opportunity for a second loan down the road. They maintained the relationship by paying back the loan. So then he went to a bank and said, "You should make loans to poor people." And the bank says, "We can't do that. They don't have any collateral," which is true. And that's a whole other topic. So these are essentially uncollateralized loans. And the way it works typically is you will get a loan for something that will pay back in order 6 months. The two most common examples are seeds, which you plant and then harvest, and then you sell the crops. And the other is goats. Goats have turned out to be the most efficient animal for converting plants to milk. And so you buy a goat, you sell the milk money pays back the loan. That is not exactly the way out of poverty. The way it really works to get out of poverty is you buy a loan, you buy a goat, you pay back the loan, you buy a second goat, you pay back the loan. After a while, you have a herd of goats and some employees and maybe even some land that you bought, and now you're out of poverty. So it's the sequence of loans that gets you out of poverty, and that's why both the repayment rate is so high, 98%+ of the loans get repaid. Again, even though there's no collateral and the people are poor, the repayment rate's very high, right? And the hidden secret to that is that most of the loans go to people that have already paid you back in the past. So although they don't have a credit history, you have something better, which is a personal history with that loanee where you know they paid you back in the past. So that's the secret to microfinance, is you loan to people that you already know will pay you back. But this is the most effective mechanism known for getting someone out of poverty, right? That sequence of loans. 46% of the borrowers get out of poverty this way. But what started 30 years ago as a few loans of $100 is now many, many loans with a $4 billion portfolio and $300 million loaned out in the last year. Right? Again, all in small amounts. And this is just from Grameen Bank. Worldwide, there's billions of dollars loaned in this kind of process in all countries. And again, what are these loans used for? They're used for local projects. It could be, again, obviously goats and seeds, but also if you need a tractor, this is where that money comes from. Or if you need to fix the well, this is where that money comes from. Right? Those are good microfinance kinds of investments. So those are two examples of where does the money come from to do development on the bottom-up approach. What do you use it for? Now, I told you about goats and seeds, but I want to bring up two different examples because they're actually technology examples. So a different guy, Iqbal Khadir, also Bangladeshi, said, well, instead of making a loan for a goat, let's make a loan for a cell phone. And that's about $200 all in when you include the batteries and things like that. So what we'll do is we'll loan cell phones to women in particular. We can talk about why women later, but it turns out women pay back their loans in Bangladesh and men don't, to first order. So we'll loan money for a phone to the phone lady. They're called phone ladies. She'll buy the phone. Then she will rent the phone per minute to her neighbors. So the way she pays back her loan is the incremental per minute revenue from the usage. So she might pay the carrier a certain amount, and then she pays a delta over that is what her profit is, and that's enough to pay back the loan. Now, essentially, the reason this works in Bangladesh is a couple-fold. I'll get to one reason now and one reason later. The first reason it works is there's no payphone mechanism like there is in India or China. So, in fact, if you're in a rural village before this program, you didn't really have access to a phone at all. Right, so these phone ladies became essentially the payphones of their village, with the exception that these payphones will bring the phone to you when the call's for you. Right? It's handy service, even if it's the middle of the night. They will also, of course, they know the people in the village, and in general, they know lots of things that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to know, such as the international dialing codes for different countries. They might even know city codes for important cities, so they can facilitate more business on their phone. So this village phone has been done almost 100,000 times, meaning there's 100,000 women that have these phones in Bangladesh. That's led to about 50,000 villages having phone coverage, right? That previously did not have phone coverage. So what I want to get from this example is that this is essentially a kind of franchising where the franchisee is not actually putting up the capital, which would be the model for, say, McDonald's or Starbucks, but the franchisee is instead just managing the microfinance loan, building the business, and operating it. So in that sense, it really is a franchisee model. And because you can scale this model, it's actually worked. And now there's 60 million people that are using this cellular network, which makes it actually one of the larger cellular networks in the world. Right? Not the largest, but certainly in the top 10. So it scales. This approach scales, is what I want you to get from that. It's also good for the phone lady. It's about twice as good to be the phone lady as to be a farmer in terms of the annual income. And the other thing to learn from this example is that she makes it work. And I mean that very literally. She will buy extra batteries. She knows how to charge the batteries. She will take care of the phone in a way you might take care of your child, right, in terms of care and feeding. In one extreme case, which I can't explain, a phone lady actually bought and installed an external GSM antenna to increase her coverage range, because I guess she was at the fringe of coverage. Now, how an illiterate woman in Bangladesh knew to get an external GSM antenna, I have no idea, right? But the point is, the women are not dumb. In fact, these women are, in some sense, self-selected based on intellect because they knew to be the phone ladies. So they're, in some sense, probably proportionally smarter than average. But they'll figure things out like that, right? So they make the system work. And I think it's important because most technology projects in developing countries tend to be things that you install them and then you leave and 6 months later they aren't working. This is particularly true for computers in schools where once something goes wrong with the computer, there's no one to fix it. And so in this case, the woman is the person who fixes it. Even if she can't fix it, she will cause something to be done to fix the situation because she needs the income. Another one which we facilitated a little bit is this group in rural India. What they do is kind of what you think of Indian outsourcing groups do. They take audio files from doctors and they transcribe them into text. So if a U.S. doctor wanted to do that dictation transcription, they would essentially, whether they knew it or not, send it to a company that oversees and in Bangalore typically or in Chennai would do the transcription and send it back the next morning. Right? We do that because it's cheaper to get these files transcribed in Bangalore than it is to do it in the U.S. However, suppose you're a doctor in India and you want to do transcription, where do you go? Well, it turns out if you're in urban India, you outsource to rural India, because rural India is cheaper than urban India. So these are doctors that are in the state of Kerala in a variety of towns. The language is Malayalam. It's not even English or Hindi. And they send their files to this little, literally this room in rural Kerala. It's about 30 kilometers from anywhere. And the staff here gets about 5 or 8 cents per line, which ends up being about $8 an hour, which is quite a good job for the group. They end up actually transcribing each file 3 times because they're not very good at transcription because they don't know the language all that well. But if you transcribe it 3 times, the parts that are the same are probably right, and the parts that are different, you have a more senior person correct. Right, so labor is so cheap they can have 4 people look at every document, right, and still make a profit. What I like about this is essentially Wi-Fi-enabled rural income. Right? The reason they're doing this job here is because this is where they want to live. This is their home village. So they can now they get to live in their home village and make enough income to stay. In fact, make quite a bit more income than average for that village. It's way more than 2x. So these are bottom-up businesses. That's what I wanted to get across from that. So now I'm going to shift gears. That's my opening background on development and my perspective on it, which is really to focus on the bottom-up version, which is not the traditional model for development, but I think is a good fit for technology. Next little thing I want to talk about is communications. So I just told you how fantastically successful cellular has been, but the answer is there's a black spot on it, which is that it's a largely urban phenomenon. In particular, this is because a base station has a circular radius, and you need a certain number of users in the radius of that base station to justify the cost of the base station. Right? In an urban area where you have good power and buildings, you might be able to put up a base station for $25,000. In a rural area where you don't have power and don't have roads and things like that, it's $100,000. Because you have to build a tower, you have to build a road to the tower, you have to put in a diesel generator, you have to bring gas or diesel to the generator on a regular basis. So all in, you're something like $100,000. So the bottom line is there aren't enough rural users to justify that cost, and therefore, they're generally speaking, are not rural base stations. And I just told you Bangladesh has all these villages that are covered. What I didn't tell you is there were no new base stations deployed. Right? This only worked in Bangladesh because Bangladesh is an incredibly dense country, 166 million people in an area smaller than California, I believe about half the size of California. So basically, the villages that this didn't work in are exactly the villages that didn't have coverage. Right? They stopped at 50,000 villages not because there weren't more villages, but because there weren't more villages that were in coverage, and the loan model doesn't cover the infrastructure, it only covers the phones. The other exception to this general principle, by the way, is China, where there are definitely places like the Great Wall where there are base stations, even though there's not enough population to justify it. Right? That's because the government's decided they want coverage in those areas, and it's not profitable, and they know that. But if you need it to be economically viable, then you need to be in urban areas. And I hope that will change over time. I'm certainly working on changing it. In fact, one of our new projects is to build a low-cost GSM base station using a PC and a software radio. But it's a very difficult challenge. So the way I want you to think about this is the digital divide is not really between these rural, these low-income countries and the U.S. and Europe. It's actually between the urban areas and the rural areas. And this goes for the U.S., there are plenty of rural areas, even in this state, Central California, that have the same digital divide issues as the countries that are typically associated with it. So Bangalore and Los Angeles are very similar, right? But 10 kilometers away from Bangalore is very different than Bangalore, right? Here's a little thing I put up. These are two different malls. One is in a developing country and one's in a developed country. And the short answer is you can't tell the difference. So in the urban areas, you see the same malls with the same shops, literally the same shops, you know, not just U.S. shops, but you know, the Gap, Marks and Spencer, Zara, there is a French store. All right. So in the mall, you really cannot tell what country you're in. This one actually is Manila with the ice rink and Edmonton with the pool, which is, had I told you what cities they were, presumably not what you would have guessed. One reason the malls are popular is because they're air-conditioned, so it's the only big space that a lot of people can go for air conditioning. But the bottom line is, once you're inside the mall, you really have no idea what country you're in, right? It's particularly Manila, where the signs are in English. So it's really a rural area. Now, I just told you cell phones don't work that well in rural areas, and so our first focus was actually on rural connectivity. And so we decided to build around Wi-Fi, which is a bit of an odd choice because Wi-Fi is not made for long distances. But it's so cheap that we felt if we could get Wi-Fi to work, it would be the right solution. And in retrospect, we did get it to work, so it was the right choice. It used unlicensed spectrum. This turns out to be very, very important. It's important for basically freedom to operate, right? If you go into a rural area, if you use licensed spectrum, you have to convince the carrier to work with you. And they're like, well, what's in it for me? Why should I try this experiment? They won't do it. So if you can use unlicensed spectrum, you can try the experiment yourself, whether it's profitable or not. So that's been very important. The bigger advantage of Wi-Fi really is that because there's no big expensive base station, you can get started with very little capital. Right? You need a single access point to get started, maybe some antennas. You can then grow your network organically, where the growth of your network exactly matches your capital costs. Right? So incremental capital is very important in this model because cash is king. So the actual innovations we did were not on the Wi-Fi hardware. The hardware is completely off the shelf because we want to leverage the high volume manufacturing. But we put in a pretty much entirely new stack, all the way from the driver through the link layer and MAC layer. And, of course, we're doing this mostly for good bandwidth over long distances, but also for better use of spectrum. And I won't talk too much about the technical details of this because I want to get onto storage. But roughly, this is a graph of throughput versus distance, but distance is in kilometers. So 100 is 100 kilometers. This is the regular Wi-Fi in simulation of how much you'd expect to get over time. And roughly speaking, it's decreasing slowly because the round trip, Wi-Fi has one packet in the air at a time. So when you go a long distance, you're waiting for the speed of light, actually, to get the packet back to you. And so you have that general decline. The big drop-off occurs because at some point the timer times out and it gives up. And so it retransmits the packet. It will retransmit that packet three times, and then it'll move on to the next packet. So that drop is essentially a two-thirds drop because it's now sending every packet three times because the retransmit timer is kicked off. Even though the packet got through correctly, it assumed that it did not because it didn't get an ACK. So that's regular Wi-Fi. This is a tradition. This was done in 2006 or so. So this is 802.11a. This is our new Wi-Fi called WildNet, but again in simulation. And then we went around and deployed a whole bunch of links. So all of the colored dots are actual links that we set up. And they're not that easy to set up because you have to find two points that are 50 or 100 kilometers apart that can see each other, go to both locations, put up a router and an antenna, align them, bring power in the situation. So it's quite a big deal to do this in real life. But in general, the squares are the new one and the circles are the old one, and sure enough, the squares are getting essentially the full bandwidth regardless of the distance, which is what we want. You might notice that one out there is the current world record. It's 382 kilometers. Again, this is one Wi-Fi radio on each end, single hop, no power amplifiers, spanning 382 kilometers. We had to cheat a little bit. We cheated by putting one end in the Andes at 4,200 meters. Right. That's cheating because at this distance, you're limited by the curvature of the Earth. The Earth is not flat. We can prove it now. So what you have to do is from kind of mountaintop to mountaintop, get high enough to see over the curvature of the Earth. So what I want you to take from this slide, besides just a nice picture of Venezuela, is that we are not limited by distance. We are limited by how far you can see. All right, so if you have two points you want to connect, we can connect them if you can see. All right, and it's really that simple. Not with the naked eye, you can use the telescope, but if you can see it, we can connect it. And so that's our general approach. Now, what we did with this, starting in 2006, was set up a telemedicine system in southern India in the state of Tamil Nadu. Now, this actually is an eye hospital because India has a disproportionate share of blindness. For reasons that are not fully understood. I have a few theories that have been proposed. Part of it is a lot of sun. Countries with a lot of sun and no sunglasses have more eye damage. When I'm there, I don't wear sunglasses because it looks odd, and my eyes do get very tired. Also, another factor is a lot of indoor cooking with wood, which gives you particulate smoke in the eyes, and repeated exposure to that definitely causes problems. Another factor is diabetes, which causes eye degeneration. So the short answer is there's a huge amount of blindness in India that's preventable, and the main issue in preventing it is really getting it diagnosed. So around this hospital, we're building 50 vision centers. This is a picture of a vision center. And what you're really seeing is it's kind of a one-room clinic. I'll show you the inside in a minute. There's a 30-foot pole. That little white box on top is a Linux router. Inside, it has a Wi-Fi card, a regular PCI Wi-Fi card you can buy for $20. Then there's a directional antenna. That one's about 24 dB, and it's pointing back towards the hospital. On the inside, what you'll see basically down on the lower left is a PC with a microphone and a webcam. The webcam's on top of the computer. That's used for the doctor-patient interview, which I'll get to in a second. And then the other piece of equipment is the slit lens lamp, which the local nurse uses to do some diagnosis. So this is essentially a clinic with no doctor and one nurse. The nurse only knows about eye care. She's had 3 to 6 months of training, so she's not like a registered nurse in the U.S. sense. But 3 to 6 months of training, knows eye care, knows how to use the equipment, knows how to use the PC. When the patient comes in, the patient will meet with the nurse. The nurse will do a basic interview and fill out an index card if it's a new patient. She's the administrator of the clinic as well as the nurse. She will then introduce the patient over the video conference to the doctor in a somewhat formal way. That makes the doctor be taken more seriously. The doctor will interview the patient for typically 5 minutes, maybe 7 minutes. Then he'll make recommendations, which might be, this patient has conjunctivitis and needs some antibiotic eye drops. The nurse will then do the antibiotic eye drops on the spot. You typically would pay for, say, 3 visits at a time to help ensure that you might come back for your follow-up visit. 3 visits, I believe, it costs about 25 cents. Now, we've done this a lot, actually, so I'll get back to the numbers in a second, but we're doing about 6,000 of these doctor-patient interviews a month right now. This is the original network that we built, which has 5 centers. There's a hospital in the middle, and then each of these lines are Wi-Fi links. Some of them are multi-hop because we're bending around places where we can't see. These are relatively short links by what our current standards are, but in 2006 we didn't know how far we could go for sure, so we were relatively conservative on the distance. I think our longest active link at the moment is 85 kilometers. The advantage of this for the hospital is that when they interviewed their patients, they found that all their patients were coming from within about 10 kilometers. That's how far patients are willing to walk to go to the hospital. So outside 10 kilometers, patients simply weren't getting treated. So roughly speaking, these clinics are placed to reach that next ring of people that are 10 to 20 kilometers away, because they're the easiest to serve. They'll still go, if they need like cataract surgery, they'll have to go to the hospital. But at least to get diagnosed, they can stay in their area. That's really why this is working. But essentially, we're multiplexing the doctors. The doctors are the spare resource here. We're allowing the doctors to stay in the urban area while they can see many patients in rural areas. So this has had real impact. We've had 160,000 patients use the system so far. Each of the centers is cash flow positive because they sell antibiotics, they sell eyeglasses. They make about $460 a month in revenue, not profit, and they make a small amount in profit, and not enough to pay for the building, but enough to pay for everything else, and certainly enough to cover their operating expenses. 25,000 people can see now that couldn't see before. So if you get nothing else from this talk, that's the number. Right. Now, we didn't do the treatment of these patients, to be perfectly clear. All we did is we connected them to someone that could tell them what they needed. Right. That's really the role that we played. This is a higher number than we were expecting. This is the hit rate, in some sense, is very high. I assume it will go down over time because it was a latent demand for eye care that we're meeting. But again, these are people, like the guy on the lower right, he was blind for 7 years, and he could have been fixed that entire time. He assumed that it was not treatable, and he was wrong. Right? So all we did in his case was literally get a doctor to look at him, and in 5 minutes, he was diagnosed, and in another 2 weeks, he was cured. Right? He did have to go to the hospital. His issue was cataracts. They will do free cataract surgery for low-income patients that's subsidized essentially by the paying patients. I don't have time to go into the economics, but he was cured and was cured for free. So now we're growing. We have the original five. We've grown. Currently, we're at 33 centers, and the plan is for 50. And begin because they're financially self-sustaining, the hospital is footing that bill entirely. Now, I'm going to shift gears and talk about some of the issues that are going to affect storage. One issue is power. Power actually turns out to be storage's friend because we need durable storage because we have no power. Most people would expect that there's a problem with availability of power, that you'd have outages. What is not understood, and even we were underestimating, was how often the power exists but is at so bad a quality as to be dangerous to your equipment. So this is measurements from two Indian villages of the actual power coming out of the wall, and it's supposed to be 220 volts. And what we're seeing in this is that there's many, many occasions where you get 1,000 or 500 volt spikes coming out of the wall. If you plug your PC into this, you just blew out your power supply. Right? If you plug your phone adapter, which is the thing that we were noticing, is within 6 months you will lose your phone adapter, right? The little transformer for your phone. So this is a problem. We lost, in fact, 50 power adapters in because of this before we figured out what's going on. We also burned out 30 power over Ethernet ports. The way we power the Linux radio up on the tower is power over Ethernet running up the cable, so we can have one cable instead of two. Well, the power is bad enough, it'll go right through the transformer, up the cord, and burn out the Ethernet port. Now, that wasn't so bad because we had four Ethernet ports, so we could use it four times before we had to replace the board. But it's still a problem. Another problem, which we didn't expect, is low voltage. When the voltage is too low, the computer won't boot correctly, so it hangs. And that's really bad if you're having a rural relay, because someone has to go visit it or wait for the next power outage and hope that when it comes back up, it will recover. What's funny about this is these boards were designed to have a hardware watchdog coprocessor, which is a little microcontroller that essentially watches the main processor to see if it's running correctly, and if it not, reboots it. Except that the watchdog processor won't run under low power correctly either, so the watchdog was also hanging. Finally, we found that when you have power fluctuating off and on a lot, each time that happens, there's some probability you're going to corrupt the compact flash disk. Because if you're in the middle of the write, it'll get corrupted. In fact, for a while, until we fixed it, it turned out that the Linux boot sequence was writing to Compact Flash on every boot. So if you had a series of fluctuations, you would be continuously rebooting, and each time those writes had some chance of corrupting the Compact Flash. And again, then you got to visit it. The same fluctuation also damages the battery and shortens the battery life. So you might ask, why not use a UPS? Well, we did. This is with the UPS in place. And the learning from this essentially is that normal UPSs that you see in these environments are what's called the standby type. And what that means basically is when the power is there, it passes the power through the device literally like a closed circuit. It's a switch, essentially. So the spikes go right through the UPS into your equipment. You can buy an online UPS, although they cost more, and they're not actually readily available because people don't know why they would want one. And by the way, the reason the power system is so bad is because if you're powering heating units or electrical lights, incandescent lights, bad power works perfectly fine, right? The system as it's used today does not demand good quality power. It's only this new IT stuff that needs good quality power, and that's really why this hasn't been diagnosed earlier. So ironically, you do get good quality power as long as the power's out, right? When the power's out, you're running off the battery, and the power's lovely. So we did find out several fixes for this. I don't have time to cover them all, but the short answer is, since we put in our own circuits for this, we haven't lost any equipment. I mostly bring this up because it's unexpected, and it actually increases the value of reliable storage. So getting to storage. So let's take a few sad stories, but for me, or why this motivation for storage. The first one, and I think the most egregious, is there's a serious loss of African culture in particular going on right now because there aren't records stored in a durable way. The best example is actually radio tapes, which are on actual tapes. And in several countries, including Guinea-Bissau and Madagascar, which have had variations of civil war, the tapes get destroyed either unintentionally or intentionally. In the case of Guinea-Bissau, it was unintentional consequences of the civil war, where the station got damaged and or the tapes got wet, things like that. In the case of Madagascar, it's one group actually wanting to erase history and therefore literally destroying the tapes. But these are... There's been no thought put into archival storage in general in any of these countries. On top of that, there's 6,000 languages in Africa and about 9,000 worldwide. Most of these languages are dying. They will be dead in 50 years, maybe less, because people are learning new languages that are the power languages of their region, whether it's Spanish for Latin America or English for parts of Africa, French for parts of Africa. So the local languages have little... Young people in these countries have little incentive to learn their local language. And there are many, many local languages. But actually, even where there's radio stations that broadcast in the local languages, none of these things are recorded. So I asked the radio station why they don't record their programs, and it's literally they don't have any storage. Right? They can't. And again, these are stuff they have actually a $25,000 radio studio in one case where they actually can put on live productions. This is, again, one of those top-down development projects. Someone donated a radio station to them but didn't donate any storage. So even though they transmit, whatever, 12 hours a day, there's no record of what they've ever transmitted, right? Just because no one thought about it. So those are a few of the motivations, in my mind, for really getting storage widely deployed. That's about local content. Another example I want to give comes from a project led by Randy Wang, now in India, still associated with the University of Washington, called Digital Study Hall. What he's doing is recording on DVD local language lectures done by a really good lecturer on that topic. So take the best teacher that teaches, say, fractions, record that lecture, and then give that lecture to other teachers that are teaching the same content in the same language in other places. This is particularly important for math, science, and English because the teachers don't know the material, right? In general, if you know math and science in a lot of these countries, you can get a better job elsewhere, right? If you know English, you certainly can get a better job elsewhere. So although English is in the curriculum in India and many other countries, we've met many students that after 5 years of English don't know the alphabet correctly, right? 5 years, right? That's because their teacher doesn't know English, right? So the hope is you can augment the teacher with the DVD. We call it mediation. Actually, it's not my project. I call it mediation, the idea that the teacher is presenting the DVD, but what's really going on is the teacher is learning from the DVD along with the students and managing the process. So this is a different kind of storage and distribution problem. They have about 1,500 recordings so far and about 30 schools participating. This is one of, I think, the good uses of storage, which is educational material. And again, not totally underutilized worldwide. This is, we have 30 schools we're talking about, a very tiny fraction of the world. So how I want you to think about storage in this scenario is, first of all, we need storage badly for two reasons. I think my main reason is to capture local content while it still exists. The secondary reason is to bring in global content. The systems are mostly intermittent, which is why I wanted to cover power. So the network is intermittent. I mean, our Wi-Fi network for telemedicine is a high-quality, low-latency network, but that's only for that hospital. If you go to the regular internet network, it's very intermittent. And the power, of course, is intermittent. So you can't build a continuously on system with intermittent networking, intermittent power. It's not going to work. And in practice, storage is bandwidth. Right? We're using storage essentially and sneakernet as our primary mechanism of bandwidth. That's how all the big bits get moved. They're DVDs in the postal system. Right? They're not actually sent over satellite. Satellite, by the way, for perspective, $6,000 a month for 1 megabit per second. Right? So, 100 times DSL cost for international satellite, which is what you need to use if you're in Africa. So instead of that, what happens is you need to use the bulk of your data has to come in some physically moved entity like a DVD, that's the current favorite, or maybe USB drives, as we've done in the conference proceedings. And then you can use the network, including the cellular network, for small updates. So I want your mental model to be bulk data plus deltas. And there's lots of ways to do the deltas. In fact, we do deltas over USB keys also. But that's how we're going to build some kind of distributed storage system. And because of this, the focus is on synchronization and not on remote access. You're going to have a local copy of the data, and therefore it's going to be inconsistent with the master copy, wherever that might be, and you're going to have to synchronize those copies over time. So this is fundamentally in the model of Bayou and Coda, of a disconnected file system with some kind of synchronization and inevitably conflict resolution. I'll come back to conflicts in a minute. So we did at FAST a couple years ago an attempt at a storage system for this environment, and I won't talk about it too much since there's a whole paper on it that appeared in this very room 2 years ago. It is a mostly disconnected file system. I think the difference is it's not a file system that's sometimes disconnected. It's a system that's mostly disconnected and only very occasionally connected. So that shifts your view on how long to expect to get a synchronization update. It's not unreasonable to think you might not get an update in some of these situations for a week or a month. Right? So your window of inconsistency could be much larger than you might typically expect with the idea that you're going to take your phone in the subway, and when it comes back up in the subway, it's going to resync, right? Kind of what Google Calendar might do. So that's part of it. Also, because the bandwidth was limited, we needed to focus to limit the scope of replication. So if you have a master file like a wiki, maybe you only want to replicate some subtrees of that wiki, the part that's important for that particular village, like the part that's in that language, for example. So limiting the scope was important. And finally, we decided because we were going to have these long inconsistency windows, what was important is that you always had a locally self-consistent version. So the way to think about it is the two versions will evolve separately, and they have conflicting updates, but if you look at one independently, it is completely self-consistent. Right? Even though there's these other conflicting updates that might have arrived, we won't show them if it'll make it locally inconsistent. That kind of preserves what you would expect in the traditional rural environment, which is, if I do something via postal mail, what my own worldview is self-consistent, and it might be that I'm wrong in my view, but at least it's self-consistent. So that's kind of, I would argue, the best you can do in this situation. Now, conflicts are unavoidable. I think there's some theorem about that. So it's not possible in general to avoid conflicts, but it actually has been okay in practice to design the system around the idea that by leveraging application semantics, we're going to make conflicts not matter. And so, in fact, we're able to build three different applications where essentially, even though we have this long inconsistency window, they're not actually meaningfully inconsistent. So a good example is data collection. we'd have many people doing data collection for, say, rural healthcare records, things like that. As long as the mental model is that these records are append only, they're never really modifying the same record. So as long as we get the merging of records correct and make sure we have independent names, then we'll never have a conflict. Right. So that model, the append model, works quite well. And we've figured out other tricks for email and for web cache. In fact, Coda did this as well a little bit. Coda had a trick to make directories consistent, even though it couldn't make files consistent. And that's the same game. They knew enough semantics about what a directory was that they could merge directory updates automatically without having to involve the user. Now, because this is a general system, there will be applications where you cannot hide the conflict from the user. And then this is an issue that's not really in the literature, which is how do you present conflicts? Right? The way it happens, for example, in Palm Pilot is it'll end up in your context list making two copies of the same contact that are inconsistent. And that's up to you to later delete one or to merge them by hand. That's what I mean by presentation. How do you expose the fact that there is a conflict? So our first choice is always avoidance, but since it's not possible in general, we have to deal with conflict presentation. The best example we have of this so far is actually a distributed wiki. A wiki is a good thing to use for content distribution. So there's a master copy of the wiki, and then each village is essentially running its own wiki and updating it locally, and then we merge them through synchronization. In the case of a conflict for a wiki, it turns out it's pretty easy to just show in HTML, merge both versions on the same page, because you know where the edit's supposed to be applied. So in that case, we just capture the fact that there are two changes made to the same thing, and we'll just show them both. And someone at the village or someone at the master side could then fix that directly, and then the updated version will eventually resynchronize. But I also wanted to point out on this is that we had no problem with users understanding the conflict resolution model. And this was a surprise to me, but the short answer is if all of your life is based on high latency communication, like people walking to the village and back and mail, postal mail, then you already know what inconsistency is, right? It's not a new concept, right? The idea that someone on the remote side would disagree about you because they didn't get your message is completely common, actually, like more common than it is here, right? Or maybe it was equally common here 100 years ago, and now we've forgotten that's natural life is with conflict. The check is in the mail is essentially one of those examples. So this has not actually been a problem at all, but I do think presentation remains as an underappreciated, essentially user interface issue. And I actually know only work I know on that really, and I could well have missed some, is back when Xerox PARC did Bayou, they did a calendar application. They had one tech report on how do you do the UI for the calendar to show stale events. But other than that paper, which is not even in the proceedings, I don't believe, I don't know of any work on how do you present conflicts to the user in a way that's effective. So some storage goals, then I'm going to take questions. One goal is to capture cultures while we can. I have one project, I have a meeting on actually on Monday, which is, we'll see if it can take off or not, which is to essentially give digital cameras to many African photographers and just have them essentially ship smart the storage cards back and forth to somewhere, say London, and just start collecting African photographs taken by Africans. Most African photographers don't own their equipment. The equipment belongs to their employer. So in fact, they don't actually take any pictures other than what's the pictures needed for their job. And the cameras are so cheap and it's so inexpensive to send the cards back and forth that we should be able to fix this. That's a little harder for video, and I'm not quite sure what to do for audio yet, but I think the same approach should work. Educational materials of all kinds, vocational materials, diagnosis materials for plants and animals. There's been some work on video diagnosis for how to tell what's wrong with your crops. All that stuff is great content, and the real issue there is generating the content, of which I think some people are working on, but certainly there's not a general mechanism for how to distribute it, and it should really have this kind of synchronized file system model. Medical records are the most famous thing that's talked about a lot. There are lots of people working on this, although I still think it has a ways to go. I will say that in the cases where there's been electronic medical records in rural areas, there's been some tremendous impact, more than you would expect. In Tanzania, there was a project where they basically did what are called verbal autopsies. So after a child dies, they go interview the family to figure out what the cause of death was. And what they learned from those interviews was essentially that the actual cause of death, which is in fact more often than not, tuberculosis, did not match what they thought the cause of death was, which was malaria. In fact, they were misallocating their meager healthcare funds too much to malaria, not enough to tuberculosis. And because they had no records on what the actual causes were, they didn't know this. And of course, they fixed that, but only for the two counties, essentially, that had those studies done. It never spread to all of Tanzania, which is a shame. So I'll stop here and take questions. The questions are, I think, an important part of this space because it's so different. There is a larger role for technology to play. I think the focus should be on rural areas. The urban areas will be just fine. They're going to take care of themselves. It might take a while. Might be bad for the environment. Might be ugly. But it's I would say, the first order on track. Rural areas are not on track in any country. There's many needs. And I think because connectivity and power are so bad, it actually makes storage more important. Storage is an important part of the bandwidth environment. And, of course, there'll be lots of need for training and support, and storage has a role to play there. And finally, my bigger picture message is I do believe in this decentralized development model. It's driven up by bottom-up funding and, in particular, by bottom-up needs. The reason these projects work is they're inherently localized. It's people spending their own money on their own projects, and they know what's important to them. And they tend to pick more wisely than any external body could pick. All right, I'll stop here and take some questions. Thank you. We have quite a bit of time, actually. I believe we have mics too, although I don't know where they are. Or you can yell and I'll repeat your question. I can barely see, unfortunately. That's per year, $40 billion per year flow into Africa. Yeah. In fact, there's also additional flows that you didn't talk about, which are actually within Africa. For example, there's big flows from Libya into Egypt. I'm sorry, Egypt into Libya, because Egypt is a relatively more wealthy country than Libya. But these are just external from developed countries into underdeveloped countries, $40 billion a year for Africa, and more than that, much more than that into India and China, which I didn't even count. Because they don't have the same needs, frankly, as Africa and Philippines and Latin America. But yeah, it's a stunning amount of money. It's just, it will fund all the things you might want to do, basically, if we can figure out how to tap it. There must be other questions. Yeah, I think the question was really, what's the funding mechanism for this work, and are my students able to have a kind of normal computer science PhD path? And the answer to that has been interesting, actually. The original money came from an NSF ITR grant. ITR, people may or may not know, was a cross-division call for proposals, and it was particularly well-suited to this kind of work where I can appeal to social science and mechanical engineering and electrical engineering, or SICE. They have not had a call like that since then, and in fact, all my proposals since then have been smaller because they have to be just computer science or just social science, and that's a mistake for NSF, which I think Jeanette Wing would agree with, although it's not that easy for her to fix. So that original five-node network in India, the telemedicine network, that was actually entirely funded by NSF. The build-out since then was funded by the hospital using their own funds. In terms of the PhD path for students, the telemedicine solution was a PhD for Sunesh Sarana. Kirstor was a PhD for Bowie Du, and he presented it here. I've had 7 students graduate with PhDs in the last 2 years, which is kind of my initial tranche of PhD students. It's been pretty easy in the networking space to get PhDs because we had delay-tolerant networking, which I didn't talk about, which is basically how to build networking stacks that work well over intermittent networks. We had a PhD in that. We've had a PhD on cell phones and sensors, about how to collect environmental data on cell phones. We've had 3 or 4 social science PhDs in addition, but just computer science has mostly been around networking systems with real-world deployments like the telemedicine. And that has, what I typically tell them is you need to have at least 1 or 2 chapters that any technologist would be proud to call their own, that they're technically deep. And if the other four or five chapters are more on the environment and the uniqueness of the situation and the deployment, that's fine with me. And that tends to be how we work. We do have fewer publications per student than I think in general for systems students, because each paper is a lot more work. But I will say the papers, I would argue, have more impact.
Isn't it?
I think there's two mics, actually. There were two before.
As you, Ashwin Goel, yes, Ashwin Goel, University of Toronto.
Yes, nice to see you again.
As you yourself have mentioned, there's been a phenomenal growth in the number of cell phones in various developing countries. Going to India every few years, I find the cost of cell phones, right now they're being served at something like 1 cent a minute.
In India, that's,
right.
Yeah.
So 1 cent a minute is the price of cell phones. Why do you think that the same thing can't happen for infrastructure, like power and internet? So essentially much more improved power and internet services available in both rural and urban.
Well, I think rural, we don't know how to do it yet, at least not provably. So rural is a harder case. Urban, I think you are seeing... You know, you're seeing WiMAX deployment in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and in lots of capital cities around the world. 3G is coming to all those cities. So I think the urban mega cities will have, I was just talking to someone from Amman, Jordan. Amman, Jordan now has $40 a month WiMAX throughout the city, right? And so I think that's typical of what's coming in urban areas only. Rural areas, that are, none of those solutions apply because of the infrastructure cost. On the power side, I think that isn't really going to get solved until there's more support for decentralized generation, which is coming. In fact, it's popular in certain countries, like Kenya has a very large home solar industry where people have kind of 100-watt solar systems on their house, even maybe if they're on the grid. I know one Kenyan woman said she had a solar system even though her house was on the grid, and it was so literally, her quote was, so I can pick the 3 hours that I have power. It was a control issue. That'll take, I think that technically actually that's possible, but it's policy-wise been quite difficult.
I would tend to agree with you on the power, but for internet, why don't people use cell phones themselves?
The per-minute rates for data are higher than the per-minute rates for voice, and actually India is the exception on low cost. In Africa, it's much more like 10 cents a minute, and an SMS is 25 cents or 50 cents each. Right. Now, part of that is the demand is high and the network is growing so fast that even at those high prices, there's still demand. So the prices aren't going to come down anytime soon. Part of it is a lot of the carriers are monopoly carriers and they don't have any incentive. But one reason the cellular infrastructure has grown and the prices have come down has been competition. India has six carriers. Right? That's why that number is at 1 cent. But a lot of it is macroeconomics. But our job in technologists, I think, is to provide new technology options that make sense from a cost perspective, and then those, and hopefully with the right policies, those will take off. All right, you've been very patient. I can hear you. Because the chipset is $3. There's no radio you can buy that can go that distance for that price. The antennas are cheap. Though, I mean, the Venezuela antenna is a bit unusual because that's 31 dB. But the regular antennas we use are about $80. Like the whole, I didn't give you a price, but that whole one pole, one Linux router with the radio and antenna, that's like $200. And another 300 if you want to power it with solar, which we also have working. It's vastly cheaper than any other solution, order of magnitude. Well, a microwave link, which would be the traditional way to do that, like if you go to California, what do carriers use to backhaul their wireless, their cellular traffic? It's microwave links. Those are $20,000 for each side. Right. So we're kind of competing with that. And we're $500 to $1,000 for each side, depending a little bit on the tower. But we don't need the same kind of tower because we only the equipment's very light, has very little windage, which is how much wind resistance it has, and it only draws about 10 watts versus, say, a kilowatt for a microwave station or 4 kilowatts for a cellular base station. These are solar-powered, actually, in many cases, which is a big win, because it means you don't need the diesel generator.
Actually, while Randall is going over there, okay, I'll ask a question. So Kim Keaton, HP Labs. Other disciplines like public health and the medical community have been going into developing regions for a long time, doing public works. What lessons can we, as a field, learn from those fields and their endeavors?
I've certainly learned a lot about field work. You should view it as my students do field work in the traditional sense of the word. And in fact, we generally speaking follow the social science protocols for field work, which in the case of things like patients means you need to get approval for human subjects testing, which we do in some cases need to get, even though the host country may not require it. Berkeley requires it, as I think they should. I've had most of my students, like Sinesh, who did the telemedicine, we counted over a 5-year period, he spent 141 days in India. I have a student, Melissa, who's a social science student. They have a 1-year field requirement. So she'll spend a full year in her PhD, but she's actually already been there 16 months. So that's a bit more extreme, and that was mostly continuous. So she lives in Uganda now, and we communicate, obviously, over the internet. But more typical is students go a few times for usually a week or two at a time, sometimes summer. Summer we get a lot of stuff done. We tend to do projects, deployments in winter break and summer break. So our general plan is to upgrade the system every 6 months. And that's actually good for other reasons because it tends to, when you start these projects, your partners are very skeptical because they've heard a million stories about how technology is going to save them. Right. And so they'll say, yes, we'll do it, but they aren't actually taking you seriously. They're just playing along. But if you start delivering something in 6 months, then their tone changes. You deliver something bigger a year out, now they're engaged and they're bought in. So it's very important to show results quickly because, again, they're used to a 5-year plan and they don't take it seriously.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Eric, actually, I'm very impressed by this presentation. So one of the questions I have is, with the emergence of cloud computing, I think that cloud computing paradigm can help small app builders. Like today, you have many apps for iPhones and so on. So have you given any thought about how to enable the local people in these developing countries to build, in their universities even maybe, local apps which will be more relevant to the villagers and other people there, and to really, you know, stimulate more usage of these cell phones, apps, or smart apps, and thus really, yeah, you know, it's a positive cycle.
So you might guess I'm a big fan of cloud computing. It's a very interesting topic. So first, let me tell you what the state of the situation is. The state of the situation is there are cloud apps. Probably the most popular is Yahoo Mail, which are widely used and work remarkably badly. And I've told this to Yahoo, so it's not news to them, right? The reason they work badly, and it's not just Yahoo's Hotmail and others, Google, Gmail. Email is the number one app, by the way. I didn't say that. But every Yahoo Mail transaction typically requires multiple HTTP requests to a server that's in another country, typically in a different continent, right? So even though it's a cloud application, the cloud itself is not on the continent. And therefore, it's a slow and almost not functional system. So in that case, I've actually been pushing Yahoo to move to something based on IMAP, where you actually can move the body of the messages down while you have connectivity and then read them offline in this kind of synchronization file system style that I just described. IMAP fits that pretty well. SMTP side is fine. It already does this. But the access side for email is still based on webmail generally, right? So that's one answer. Another answer is I've been trying to work with different countries to actually help them put in data centers in their country that could be a host facility for cloud computing. So I've done that a little bit in Rwanda. There's an IT park in Kigali that has actually some tier servers in it. Ghana now has an internet exchange point in Accra, which is a logical place to put computers. I guess the Kofi Annan computer center next to it. So there's room for computers, but there aren't any computers there. And even when there are computers there, most services still go to clouds that are in London or the U.S. Typically, they go to London or Washington, D.C. via satellite. And so, in fact, even if you send email to your friend next to you, it actually goes through many satellite hops to typically Washington, D.C. or U.K. Multiple times. So the whole system is not designed. I'm also pushing Nokia, because Nokia has a lot of presence in these countries, to consider doing lots of small data centers in different countries as a way to get a competitive advantage in these spaces for smartphones down the road. I'd also say when you talk about apps, you probably have in mind traditional cloud computing apps which are web-based, but all the apps that people care about are phone apps. And so they still need cloud support, but it's a little bit different kind of support. The tools are different. There is some work in Nairobi on SMS applications. There's a kind of a community that's risen in Nairobi that has a lot of local SMS knowledge and SMS gateways. So there are some of this happening. That's kind of a cloud because the SMS servers are local to Nairobi. But if you want to do something that's what you think of as cloud, those will still go far away. And that's going to have to change.
Hi, Margot Seltzer from Harvard University. So at this point, I'm guessing you have enough connections that you can find these opportunities and partnerships. But how did you get started?
It wasn't easy to get started. The good news is I can help other people get started without going through what I went through. Our first year in India, which is 2003, we interviewed literally 80 different groups to work with. We intentionally started in India because India is safe, speaks English, and has the equivalent of fries, for people that know what that is, which is the ability to buy random components in Bangalore or Chennai of pretty much any type you want. I should get a picture of it. It's like a bazaar, like you think of as a traditional market with lots of little booths. But instead of being fruit, it's Ethernet cables and USB dongles and monitors, but just like a square mile of little stores. In Chennai in particular is the one I'm thinking of. So you can get stuff which you can't get in, say, Congo. So India is an easier place to work, and I generally would recommend starting there for a variety of reasons. Africa has more need, but the work is much harder. Things cost about 2.5 times as much in Africa in general because logistics are bad. I mean, you can't if you don't bring your UV Ethernet cable with you, you cannot buy one, right, that kind of stuff. So we met with lots of groups. We didn't know what we were looking for. We ended up working with three of the groups, and none of those first three projects are actually projects that were alive 3 years later, although one of those partners was Aravind Eye Hospital. We started on a different project with them, which is actually on image recognition to help diagnose diabetic retinopathy, a very technical problem, actually still a valid problem that people could work on. But once we found out what they were trying to do with the rural areas, we said, well, this is a much better fit for what we have, and we switched projects to that, and that's where that came from. So now I know what to look for in the partners, and I could kind of enumerate that. But the most important thing probably is it's good to go with private NGOs that have a long track record, that are more stable than the government, they're more consistent in mission, and therefore they're more predictable. And you need to pick projects that align with their mission. If you pick a project that doesn't align with their mission, even if they say they're interested, when times get tough, your project will get dropped. And we have had that happen.
Howdy. S.W. Worth, Microsoft. It strikes me that a lot of the examples you cite are the successful ones are fundamentally successful because of property rights issues. That is, there's a way for people to pay and get paid up and down the chain. The phone lady in Bangladesh, for example, can support the infrastructure for the phone, you know, the phone system to work. And counter to that is that's the example why power doesn't work because it's so easy to steal. Are you seeing that same thing?
I would generally agree with that, although one thing we found we didn't talk about in this talk is that if you want clean power, like to run a computer, it actually costs 20 times than buying the power. Right, when you factor in the short lifetime of batteries that you have to buy recurringly. So there's no such thing as buying the UPS and then you're done. You actually need to buy new batteries for it every 9 months if you're using that kind of power. And that ends up, the batteries are $80 each. You end up paying more for the batteries than you pay in underlying power in India. India has relatively cheap power. It is the case in India that about half the power is stolen or leaks. They can't differentiate the two. That's a kind of intentional subsidy. I mean, the government is not unaware that it's losing this power. The hope is that the people that are stealing it actually need it, although I can assure you that's not the case. There's people that need it steal it, and people that could pay for it also steal it. So I think power is a tricky one on that front. And there are actually open IT projects on how to fix the loss of power issues. Because again, they're losing $3 billion a year in power at least, so there's plenty of money to pay for solutions actually. Although that's a more traditional problem, and I'm not actually working on it. I'm working more on the decentralized generation and microgrids, which I think will be a better solution for rural areas. But I would think there is, having a value chain is, I think, a common theme among the successful solutions. It works better if it's somebody's living, because then they're engaged. I can go in the front
Megan
if you don't
Wingate,
see
me. Megan Wingate, Los Alamos National Laboratory.
I don't see you. The light is like really bright in my eyes. That's why I can't see.
I'm fascinated by the idea of remote eye problem diagnosis. It seems like when I go to the eye doctor, they're using the blue light looking at the back of my retina. Is the doctor actually looking into the back of their eye, or is that something the nurse is doing?
We've done both. The nurse normally is looking in the back of the eye. We have, with the hospital, created a digital camera with a special lens so you can take a picture of the back of the eye and transmit it over the link to the doctor. We thought that would be a big deal, but it turns out it wasn't that big a deal. The root reason for that is developing region doctors, their main technique is the interview, and they're really good at it, extraordinarily good at it, because they don't have lab results to look at, basically, generally speaking. So the most important thing for them was actually the video conference interview and having it be TV quality. We did provide the ability to send data also, and we use it, but it's like maybe 3% of the cases use the images. In fact, I had a question on a previous talk, why does a blind person need a video conference? And the answer is so the doctor can see them. It's not really, at the end of the day, for the patient. It's for the patient in the sense that they see the doctor, they're more likely to follow the doctor's directions. It increases the doctor's credibility. But it's more so the doctor can see the patient, which is part of the interview technique. And that's something I didn't appreciate at first.
Itzhak Berg, Technion. You mentioned in an early slide that high birth rates imply more poverty. Do you or do you know of anyone else studying whether such projects have any effect on that?
There's two studies I've heard of. There's one general study which says basically that there's a strong correlation between education levels of women and birth rates. So more educated women have less children in all cultures. There's another one which I haven't seen the primary source for, which says that there's an even stronger correlation between living in an urban area and birth rate. And that could have two different factors. Part of that's education. Part of that is in rural areas you're having more children because they're farmhands, essentially, and the need for farmhands goes away if you're living in an urban area. So there's a question about whether or not urbanization is good or bad for long-term population growth. If you go by the existing statistics, I think you would argue that it's a slightly more important factor than education, but I don't really believe that. I actually think education is the core issue, and giving women more options is really the essence of it. But I don't think I'm not the person to answer that question directly, but it is a fairly widely studied thing.
Paul Stanton, Johns Hopkins University. I worked on an IT capacity building project in Kabul, Afghanistan, and one of the obstacles we faced was that as soon as we had the IT people trained, it was more lucrative to go elsewhere.
Absolutely.
Have you experienced the same phenomenon? And are your projects self-sustaining? And if you have, how do you incentivize your IT staff to stay with the project?
We did encounter that, and I actually like our solution. In the case of the telemedicine solution, is where we have the most experience, because that's been a long-running project. We did find that if you train the IT staff of the hospital, they would leave. The hospital, by the way, views that as a positive thing, that that's good for the community and the society, and they're willing to do with that. In fact, they have the same thing on the doctor's side. They train doctors. The doctors then go into private practice, and they lose the doctors. Right? But their view on that philosophically is that is for the good of the country, and even though they have to retrain people every year, it's okay. From my perspective, what we actually ended up doing, which I like a lot, is we made the support system into three parts, which I don't, I might have a, I do have a slide on it. Let's see if I can find it. It's coming up. There we go. So when we started, these are kind of the four IT tasks that we had to do: maintenance, management, installation, equipment supply, and we did them all. So green is basically, think Berkeley grad students. Then we started to teach the hospital, which is blue, to do some of the maintenance, and we actually gave them web interfaces to make it easier. One thing I didn't mention about Wi-Fi is, because Wi-Fi has been made for consumers, it's actually a much more approachable technology than other networking technologies, because it tends to come just easier to manage. But the real breakthrough was the yellow, which was we hired a local vendor whose previous work was installing stuff on cell towers. So their main business is working for cellular carriers. So they knew about RF and power, and we just trained them how to install the Wi-Fi links. And they are higher paid than the IPT staff of the hospital. And so basically by having the three-tier model where the IT staff really only does the web interface, and therefore they don't need much training, and therefore they don't leave. Or if they do leave, you can retrain them quickly because the learning curve is small. The yellow group, the local vendor, is actually doing, for profit, the main maintenance installation of the links. And that's $18 a link per year is the cost the hospital pays right now for that. And that is enough to keep those... enough money goes to the IT staff there to keep them in those jobs. And that, because that vendor had already figured out how to do that for the carrier space. So we just pay the same rates as the carriers, essentially. So I like this three-tier model because the yellow company really is an IT company, not a hospital. And they're not even all that rural. They go to rural areas as needed, but they live in the cities. And I highly recommended this approach, although we only have one example of its success. So it's a little bit sparse on the data, but it worked very well.
Any final questions?
I have one. Randall Burns, Johns Hopkins. So tying this back to storage, when I look at sneaker nets, there's a lot of handling, manual handling of data. And so based on your experience, what's the scalability of storage without full connectivity?
Well, one of the things we did in TierStore was make it so if you just plugged in the USB drive, it would actually do essentially the Bayou kind of bidirectional delta exchange pretty much automatically. So you have to do, it's not like you plugged it in and you had to copy files from one file system to another. It was more transparent than that. And I think that is an important solution. And other groups have done that before. There's a project in Cambodia that uses USB drives and motorcycles as their network. So you need a little bit of window dressing to make it work. But basically the model is the USB key in transit is carrying deltas, and when it's plugged in, it'll auto-detect and essentially execute those deltas on the remote side. But we had to write that. It doesn't happen by itself. So that is exactly to address the handling issues.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for a very thought-provoking talk.
Thank you. My pleasure.